Good morning, Reading. Good morning, Reading. Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you're listening to Positively Healthy here on KCNR 1460, home of Free Fire Media. And gosh, what a show we have for you today. We have future author Mark Dadigan here in the studio today, and we're going to talk about our local Winnemem Wintu tribe, and we're going to learn a lot of history today because we're talking about cultural health. You know, here on Positively Healthy, we are always trying to figure out ways to get everybody a little healthier in every part of their life. And I've had a chiropractic and clinical nutrition practice for pushing 20 years. And, you know, health is a funny thing. So when you have it, you don't really think about it. And when you lose it, it's all you think about. And so so health is one of those things where you just have to kind of keep making tiny little steps to make it better, and if you work a little harder, if you lose it, you have to kind of put the pedal to the metal and make some more drastic type changes to keep your life in balance and your immune system pumping strong. So with that, I want to talk a little bit about Japan with co-host Mark Beecham today. So Mark, let's talk a little bit about what's going on in Japan. Gosh, those poor folks are feeling a little out of balance today, I think.
Well, they had a terrible earthquake, obviously, and tsunami, and a problem that at least one of their nuclear plants, a very serious problem. But from my time in Japan, I was there about 5 years, they are much better prepared for these things, I think, than we are.
In their mind or just physically? They have water and they have food?
They have very regular earthquake and fire and tsunami drills. And so when a disaster strikes like this, they know where to go. Now, the people on the coast there, on the western coast that was hit by the tsunami, many of them didn't have time, I don't think, to get out of the way of the tsunami because it happens so close to shore. But they are people that are prepared, and then when something disastrous like this happens, or the Kobe earthquake of '90s, they get right to work, and it's a terrible disaster. I'm not minimizing that, and the loss of life is tragic, but I suspect that they will be back to a semblance of normality a lot faster than we might think.
Impressive. Okay. Well, then, on the line, we have Sandy from the Hayfork Growers Association. Sandy, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
And Sandy, what's your last name?
Bechtel.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, welcome to the show today.
Thank you much.
Yeah, well, you know, you guys over there in Hayfork, you're just getting all wound up here and getting your growers, you know, you guys are deciding that you want to have this abundant, sustainable, growing season, growing system happening over there, and you're having a little shindig on Saturday. What exactly
are
you guys up to?
Well, we started off wanting to just put on a workshop for local growers who are trying to be self-sufficient and improve their diets by living off local produce, but it's sort of snowballed into a small farm and garden show. We've got 37 exhibitors.
Nice.
4 speakers, a free lunch. It's in a heated building, and we're going to do it rain, shine, or snow. It's from 10:30 to 4 o'clock on Saturday at the fairgrounds. And we've got, tractors on display. We're having beekeepers, cheesemakers, goat producers, sort of goats on the mow if you want to rent goats to take care of your property. And we're quite enthusiastic about it. We actually wanted to launch our organization at that time, too, because we need membership. And we think this is going to be a going thing to put Trinity County on the map and help not only people's diets, but maybe their pocketbooks, too.
Oh, excellent. And then who are your 4 speakers?
Well, we're having Carol Falls, University Extension, who's going to talk on soils. And then Ernie Garcia, who owns Hemp Hill Honey, will give us a seminar on beekeeping. And Shion Rose does a nice thing on homesteading. He and his wife have lived off the land for many years. And last will be George Stevens about seed saving, and his company is Synergy Seeds. and then there'll be a little spot for us to brag about ourselves.
Oh, good. Well, gosh, it sounds wonderful. And so, you know, if there's anything else we can do to help you guys become more prosperous and get the word out, we'd like to do that.
Well,
so.
Thank you. I mean, this is such a great opportunity today because it's just upcoming next weekend.
I know. It sounds perfect. So.
Hope to see you there. You've got to do your show from there.
Wouldn't it be nice if we had that kind of technology? We'll be there. So tell us where it is again.
It's at the fairgrounds in Hayfork.
Okay, and if you're just coming from Redding.
Come down into Hayfork and make the big left-hand turn in the valley once you're in Hayfork going south, and you can't miss it. It's well labeled. It's on the left-hand side of Highway 3.
And is admission free?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
And lunch is free, too. Just bring a dish if you come. You don't have to, but it'll help.
Well, how nice is that? Two words people love, food and free. So
right. It's
like it's going to be a success. Hey, thanks for calling in, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, so we'll talk to you soon.
All righty.
All right, thanks. Hey, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. You're listening to Positively Healthy. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. You're listening to Positively Healthy here on KCNR 1460. Well, in the studio today, we have Mark Dadigan. You'll see him sometimes as a contributing writer for the Record Searchlight, and he is doing some immersion journalism with the Winneman Wintu, part of our area. And if you have no idea what I just said, don't feel left out, because you know, it's easy. I'm a born and raised here person, and there are things that just are happening in your community that you just don't really know are happening. And you know how when you are out at Whiskeytown Lake and you pull into Vista Point to use the restroom, and some nice tourist from Sweden teaches you more about Whiskeytown Lake than you've ever, you know, they ask you a question, you don't know the answer, and then they tell you 15 minutes of history about your local lake that you went to absolutely every day of your childhood. Well, we're going to do that today. So I want to introduce Mark Dadigan. Mark, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, nice to have you here. And, you know, Mark Beecham over here seems to know a little bit more about this than I do, but let's just take it from the beginning. You know, who are the Winneman Wintu?
Well, they're a small tribe that they now live on tribal land out in Jones Valley, called their village Tuamiali. There's 123 traditional Winnemum, and there's about 30 who live at the village. And Winnemum actually means middle water, and their full name, Winnemum Wintu, means the middle water people. And that refers to the McLeod River, which is, you know, bounded on one side by the upper Sacramento and on the other side by the Pit. And I always kind of like looking at the map of those three rivers, because it kind of looks like an eagle talon about to pounce on the mountains or something. But, you know, the McLeod River is, you know, their home territory, and that's where they're from. And so, you know, they were salmon people, too. They lived on that river for generations and millennia, and they were hunter-gatherers who relied on the salmon, and they gathered acorns and the other staple foods. And then there's about 14,000 or so when the first settlers started arriving, and then very quickly their numbers started to dwindle because of disease and losing their lands, and ranchers were fencing off their traditional gathering places, and gold miners were starting to harm some of the salmon streams where they would spawn and where the Winnemum would harvest them. And so by 1910, I think, the census had those numbers of the Winnemum down to about 400 or less than 400. And there's so much here, I'm hoping I'm not missing anything, but, you know, the other big thing that happened was when the Shasta Dam was constructed during World War II, that flooded, you know, the remaining villages they had in the McLeod, and also the sacred places, which are, you know, and tied to their religion and to their practices and their culture, and it also blocked the salmon from returning to McLeod, and so really any ties they had to that traditional life were almost completely destroyed by the dam. And, you know, I think it's kind of interesting that in a lot of ways it's almost like a diaspora right here within our community. And I think they would say that they're still trying to figure out what a normal life is after all that has happened to them.
Yeah, what you're describing almost is a sort of a slow motion Holocaust in a way. I mean, one disaster after another, starting with disease and then the gold rush pushing them off their lands, and then finally the dam putting paid to their food source. And yet there is precious little understanding or sympathy or knowledge of what went on here. I've been on the dam tour, I can't tell you how many times.
You can tell them.
Well, dozens, dozens over
okay,
the
at least 30.
Course of my life, and many, many times since I moved back to Reading in 2002. And yet I don't recall ever hearing much, if any, mention about the Native American populations that lived in that, along those rivers that were dammed. And certainly no mention, really, of them in connection with the plans to raise the dam by, what is it, 11 or 18 feet? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think there's a lot of reasons for that. I think, you know, even though the tribal leaders, Mark and Colleen, they're out in the media and they're talking a lot in it and they're trying to get the story out there, I think, you know, it can be hard sometimes when you're not... it seems like you call it a slow-motion Holocaust, but... really, and maybe it is compared to, say, the Jewish Holocaust or the Armenian Holocaust, but, you know, it's still very recent in their history, and it still affects them, I think. And so it's not always easy for them to tell that story. And so I think that's an issue, and also just, I think we want to talk about why they're not recognized as a tribe by the federal government, and that just legally restricts... their access to having a say in some of the development of their lands, and especially the Shasta Dam raise. And should I go a little bit more into that side of the story?
Yeah, sure.
So in the late, you know, the tribe is unrecognized, which means that the federal government doesn't have them on their list of official tribes, and that means that they have, in addition to not having much of a legal say in their lands, they also have no access to federal scholarships or Indian health services. It's hard for them even to apply for housing grants, and it really puts them in a bind and makes it really difficult for them to try and sustain their culture. They also have problems finding grants to do their language restoration projects.
Okay.
And so it makes it extremely difficult, and it's really kind of an insane process, because basically what tribes have to do is kind of conform to this government's idea of what a tribe should be. It's not the government actually accepting their definition of who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so this process was created in the late 70s, that was around the time the American Indian Movement was strong and active, and there was becoming a greater, I think American Indians in general were feeling greater pride in their culture and kind of reclaiming it. And so the government, felt the need to create this process to make sure there weren't any people falsely claiming they were tribes or who knows, really. And, they created this process based on basically a bureaucrat's definition of what a tribe is.
Hmm.
It wasn't actually ever created. The criteria for becoming recognized was not created by anthropologists or by representatives from tribes. It was bureaucracy. And it's part of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. It was not a congressional law. And right now, it pretty much, controls who is defined as a tribe and who's indigenous. And for the Winnemem, they actually were on the list of registered tribes until 1985, when there was a court case and the BIA had to amend their rules, and the Winnemem were suddenly dropped. And they've never received a reason for why they're not recognized. And some people ask them why they don't just go ahead and reapply or whatever, but in their minds...
It was the first thing that, of course, went through my mind.
Well, why should they... I think their answer would be, well, why should they apply when they know they're a tribe and they were recognized, and it's the government's responsibility to...
kind of sign them back up?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay. I can see people get...
And also what's problematic is the recognition process takes about 20 years now, on average.
That's fast.
And
hey, we need to take a quick break. This is so interesting. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the fact that you are living with the Winnemem Wintu out in Jones Valley, and it's kind of a group of, what, 30 people. Okay, because I don't think we've really established that a lot of them are still together. Tribe or no tribe, they're still a tribe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, okay. We'll be right back. This is Dr. Trudy Pratt. You're listening to Positively Healthy.
Do you have...
Welcome back. Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you're listening to Positively Healthy, and we're talking about cultural health today right here in our community. We're talking about the Winnemem Wintu, and in the studio we have Mark Dadigan, journalist, author, future author. He's writing a book about our local Winnemem Wintu, and welcome back.
Oh, thanks.
Hey, you know, so you live out with the Winnemem Wintu, and you're teaching us that they live out in the Jones Valley area. How many people live there, and what's it like?
Well, the tribe has about 123 people total, and about 30 of those or so live at the ranch here. And then, you know, the rest kind of live in different places around Northern California, and a few live in the Bay Area. And they'll all come together for the different ceremonies. And I think, you know, one thing I want to emphasize is, you know, they're still a traditional tribe, and they're still practicing all the ceremonies that they can, that, you know, that their ancestors used to practice. They're somewhat limited because, you know, their ceremonies are tightly tied to these sacred places, which are, you know, meadows or sacred pools or rock formations, and these are the places where they've always had their ceremonies and where all that knowledge is based. And, you know, there's about 90% of those sacred places are under Shasta Lake right now, and then there's other sacred places they can't access because it's owned by private property, whether that's Bali Babka or Hearst or whatever. And so, you know, I just want that to be clear that, you know, they're modern people. They have, you know, they allow them work in the community. They listen to American music. You know, Colleen the Chief, she loves Elvis, but they're still a very traditional indigenous people, and I think that's important to note. And so what was your question again?
Well, yeah, like, you live out there. How long have you lived there?
I've been there since September.
Since September. How long are you staying?
That's a good question. I've never asked that. Probably until I finish the book or they kick me out.
Ah, okay. And how far are you on the book?
I have just finished my book proposal, and it's circulating. And the truth is that I guess I could say I want to try and finish it in a year, but it might take much longer than that.
Okay, so you might be there a while.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
What do you think would be the appeal of this book? I mean, what are the themes that living there ring your bells? What is it about living there?
Well, like, you know, we were talking in the break that I'm a kid from the suburbs from Chicago, and I'm in a completely different world from where I'm from. And the reason, I think I just told them that I was out of grad school and I had no place to live and I needed a place to crash, and could I come over? And they said yes. But my kind of secret ulterior motive is that in order to tell this story in a way that is, I think, resonant to everyone, is I wanted to be there with them, and I wanted to try and feel what they felt. You know, I want to try and feel what they felt for the sacred places, and I want to be able to tell the story through their eyes. So I hope that, you know, if I can do it right, I hope that readers will read this book and feel like they're kind of being transported to a different world almost, but one that's still familiar, one that's still kind of rooted in our country, but also it's this really unique and vibrant culture unlike any they've ever really experienced before, right here kind of living amongst them. And I hope that, you know, even if you love the Shasta Dam, if it's a real important place for you, I hope that if you read this book, you'll at least understand how they feel about it and understand how they see it as destructive and how it's caused them pain. And that's not to, I don't want to try and dispute or contradict feelings opposite of that, but I just want to try and help people understand that perspective.
So what is their relationship to the salmon? Like, how is that profound in their culture?
Well, in the tribe's Genesis story, you know, human comes bubbling out of this sacred spring, and human is helpless, and none of the other creatures can understand anything human's saying. And it's salmon that comes up and says, hey, I'll give you my voice as long as you speak for me. And so, you know, there's that spiritual connection based on that. There was a covenant established.
So they owe the salmon something.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And, well, and then, you know, the other part of the story we haven't talked about yet is that, you know, they're the McLeod salmon are currently in New Zealand. And that happened because during the 19th century, I think it was early 1870s, the Baird Hatchery was established on the McLeod River. And this was set up by the federal government in the purpose of trying to supplement the dwindling Atlantic salmon stocks. And the Winnemem actually worked there at the hatchery, and that was in a lot of ways how they were protected from the various militias and gold miners who were at that time literally murdering Indians and getting bounties by the scalp for doing it. And at that time they made another agreement with the salmon. They said that they would let this man, Livingston Stone, who set up the hatchery, to take the salmon eggs and take the salmon milt and ship it around the world, but the salmon would always have a place to come back. They would always be able to come back home. And then when the Shasta Dam was built, that stopped that. But it turned out that those eggs survived in New Zealand, and they're thriving in the Rakaia River over there.
And are they being transported here? What's the plan? I mean, is that give them some type of healing, knowing that the salmon are surviving there? Is that what we can draw from that?
So big part of the book will be this past March, the tribe journeyed to New Zealand, and they held a ceremony there to atone to the salmon, a four-day ceremony on the Rakaia River. And there were Maori people there, Maori tribes, who helped them and kind of allowed them to hold a ceremony on their lands. And that they reestablished that bond there. And there was a lot of cool stuff that happened there that... you'll have to read the book to find out about.
Can't wait. Hurry up and write it. Hey, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back. Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you're listening to our show, Positively Healthy, and I'm trying to solve the world's problems here. Okay, in the studio we have Mark Dadigan, and he is a future author and a contributing writer to the Record Searchlight, and he is doing immersion journalism. He's living with our own Winnemem Wintu out in Jones Valley, and welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be back.
Good, I'm glad you're here. Well, you know, we're trying to figure this whole, you're teaching us that the Winnemem Wintu, part of their creation story is they have a relationship with the salmon, that they have sort of agreed to protect them.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So, mm-hmm. So when they aren't doing that, they're letting them down, and kind of this, you know, we talk about cultural health, we, you know, talk about spiritual health, too. Like, they don't feel so good about it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when we're trying to figure out a way for a culture to come back into health, what are their ways of making... So we have them in New Zealand. That's sort of creating balance for them, right? Because those salmon are now becoming vibrant and they have... Is that kind of what you would say?
Or, you know, they've reestablished that connection.
They've reestablished that connection, and they still have a goal of reestablishing their connection here.
Well, their goal is to bring the salmon back to McLeod, back home. And I guess, so people understand that, some people will say, well, why can't they just, bring salmon that are in the Sacramento and put them in the McLeod? But, salmon biologists, they refer to salmon by their spawning river. They'll say the McLeod River, Fall Run, or the, Trinity River, or whatever run. And that's because each salmon is so genetically adapted very specifically to its home river. That's the river it's meant to be in. And so, the Winnemem, none of those other salmon, any other rivers, are their salmon. Their salmon are the ones who originated in the McLeod River and were sent to New Zealand. And so that's why they have to bring those back there.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay, that makes sense. And so what are some of these solutions then locally?
Well, the Winnemem's plan, and they've, they've been entering discussions with government biologists about that. It's, it would be relatively inexpensive. They want to establish a small hatchery on the McLeod, and they want to rear those fish there and get those fish acclimated back to the waters they're supposed to be in. And most salmon biologists believe that it's actually the sense of the home streams that help guide the salmon back once they make it back inland. And so, and then they want to try and use a couple of natural creeks to refurbish them and connect them to Shasta Lake so that the salmon could swim down McLeod and actually go swim around the dam through the creeks and back to Sacramento and back to the ocean.
Okay, and like where? Versa. I'm trying to think of what these creeks would be.
Well, there's Dry Creek, which is actually runs.
Doesn't have a good sound to it already. I see something missing.
Mm-hmm.
Is there water in that creek?
There's sometimes.
Okay. Okay, so where's Dry Creek? It sounds familiar, but I can't
that's
really.
That's in Jones Valley.
That's in Jones Valley. Okay. Mm-hmm. Dry. Oh, yeah, Dry Creek. Right. Okay. So that's coming. So they would come up Dry Creek through where?
Yeah, I actually haven't seen a map, good map myself,
okay.
So I have a hard time visualizing it.
Okay, but part of the year they could take this mm-hmm. other route and come into the lake and keep going, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And how do you teach a salmon to do that and not just come up and...
Well,
stop,
you know,
at the dam, or
you know, I'm not the salmon expert.
Okay,
the Winnemem are the salmon people.
Okay,
and I think, you know, I think that's an interesting part of the story, and will be an interesting part
Ooh.
Of the book that you
okay.
can read about. Is so, you know, they have thousands and thousands of years of history working with the salmon, observing the salmon, and you know, they pass that down in their oral history, and. You know, you could even look at it as in a scientific view, is that's direct observation. That's thousands and thousands of years of direct observation, which, you know, none of our modern scientists have that much time.
No.
And so, you know, I kind of would trust what, you know, the salmon people would say about salmon and what they could do. And so an interesting part of the story is kind of that them working with the scientists who come from this different perspective and the interactions of the traditional science versus that indigenous way of knowing that some people call it. And, you know, I think it's not in our kind of coming from that science-based, rational Western culture, it's not our instinct to, you know, I don't want to say respect, but, you know, take that seriously, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I think...
Until it's explained to you,
mm-hmm.
and then you're like, oh.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Feels pretty serious right now to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And until you kind of understand where that comes from and where that knowledge comes from. And so I think that's an interesting aspect of the story, for sure.
How has this changed you?
Well, you know, first of all, I think I'm not a naturally... ambitious person. I'm not naturally someone who tries to be the best I can be at something.
Mm-hmm.
But being around them and having them let me tell their story, or at least try to, makes me want to be the best I can. And
wow.
So that's something that I can never, ever really pay back to them.
Mm-mm.
And also just you know, letting me into their culture and into letting me experience the ceremonies like they have is something that I can also never pay back to them fully, because you know, I grew up Catholic. I kind of grew up in a traditional church, and I've never, you know, and I've been to synagogues and I've been to mosques and different things, but I've never experienced anything that spiritual, that was that pure and you know, pristine, really.
Hmm.
And so that's, you know, I think I was a very secular person before I met them, and I think I'm much more open-minded now.
Was there an issue of you establishing trust with the tribe? I mean, were they hesitant or they standoffish at first? Did you have to sort of prove yourself, your seriousness?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny because, you know, I met Mark and Colleen when they were in Eugene. I was there for graduate school, and I met them through... a friend of a friend who knew I was interested in telling stories like theirs. And I just met them at dinner for one day. And, you know, I just told them what I wanted to do, that I want to tell stories about people who don't necessarily have a voice in a larger society. And, you know, a few weeks later, they let me come down and do a radio story. And, and you know, and then a few months later, they went to New Zealand, and I asked if I could go, and they said I could. And a lot of it was just, I think we have good similar personalities. They like to make fun of me a lot and tease me a lot, and that's all my other friends do that too. And you know, I think I was just very quiet. I wasn't Mr. Journalist guy at first. I just kind of let things happen, and I wasn't. I think sometimes if you're a journalist and you start asking too many questions too fast before you understand what's happening, you can come off as judgmental, or you can seem like you're making assumptions about things. So I knew I was in an element that was very unfamiliar to me, so that's how I tried to approach it, I think, and I think that's worked.
Okay, well, you know what? We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. This is Dr. Trudy Pratt. You're listening to Positively Healthy. We'll be back with more of Mark Dadigan after this.
Kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling groovy.
Hey, welcome back. Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you're listening to Positively Healthy. And our guest today is Mark Dadigan, a future author and journalist. And welcome back, Mark.
Thanks. I'm surprised you haven't kicked me out yet.
Hey, we love having you. And, you know, how did you get here? A kid from outside of Chicago? I mean, how did you get all the way here?
Oh, well, you know, I think it all started. I mean, I could never have guessed 2 years ago that I'd be here, that's for sure.
Where were you 2 years ago?
Well, I was starting my graduate program in narrative nonfiction at the University of Oregon.
Oh.
I had never knew nothing about salmon then, knew nothing about water, knew nothing, almost nothing about American Indian issues. And so it's been definitely a steep curve. But I think, you know, it started when I was in an undergraduate at the University of Illinois, and we read a book by a Chicago author named Alex Kotlowitz called There Are No Children Here. And in that book, he spent about 2 years living with two young children who were growing up in, at that time, the really violence-plagued projects of Chicago. And he just kind of chronicled how the poverty and the violence and just the kind of toxic atmosphere of those projects you know, affected those kids on an mm-hmm. emotional daily level. And he told it like it was a novel, and you felt like you were there and you knew those kids and you were experiencing it with them. And to me, that's always what I thought journalism was. And so I kind of bounced around at some different daily newspapers, and I went out to Oregon because I thought that program would get me closer to doing that kind of journalism. And, you know, I actually got an opportunity to sit down with Alex, the author of that book, a couple years ago, and he explained what he did really well. He said that, you know, we live in a pretty segregated society, and we don't know people different from us very often. And that leads to us having these kind of stick figures in our minds. And, you know, his job, as he saw it, and what I hope I can do, is to take those stick figures and kind of add a head and add a heart and add a body. And so you'll read the book, and you won't have as many stick figures as you used to have, and you'll have kind of a, you know, more empathy for these people who are going through things you might not necessarily understand.
Mm. Understanding other cultures, it's beautiful, and these folks are right here with us, and it's surprising how little we know about them.
Can you talk a little bit about the difference between, you're talking about this during the break, oral history and journalism?
Yeah, well, I think that's something that's helped me with work with the tribe, too, because, I grew up in the traditional journalism you know, format where you just do the five whys and who, what, when, where, and you have 20 minutes to do your interview, you go in and you have your set questions and whatnot, and you get them off really fast, and you write your story. And, you know, oral history, well, you know, I took a couple of classes at that at University of Oregon. It's much different. It's kind of more, you just kind of prompt people to start talking, and you let the people you're talking to tell the story as they want it to be told. So, you know, one of my favorite questions when I'm doing oral histories is just kind of ask, so what would you like the world to know about you? And that's, you know, a lot more open-ended, and it lets your subjects kind of guide that conversation more. And, you know, and that was, it was really great for me to have that experience doing that, because that's, you know, that's what I want to do with the Winnemem, is I want them to kind of just use me to tell their story. I don't want to be in the way. I don't want it to be me telling their story.
Do you have an agreement with them that they will review the manuscript before it's submitted, have veto rights over this or that topic? Or?
I mean, I don't think we're actually going to have a sit-down, I think, soon to talk about exactly what I have planned, because I finally have it kind of sketched out in my brain now. But I totally plan to let them see it before it's published, that's for sure. But, you know, I'll be working with them so closely on everything, you know, it's not like there would be anything that would surprise them when they see it when it's finished.
Do you think that because the economy of California is in such a bad place, by that I mean I doubt we're going to really be getting a whole lot of new, I don't think the population's really going to grow that much, and I could be wrong, but do you really think we're going to need to add 18 feet to that dam? I mean, it just sort of sounds like we aren't. I mean, do you think this problem is going to just go away for them?
I don't know. You know, there are a lot of other water experts who can talk about this more thoroughly than I can, but, you know, at that, I went to that Shasta Dam history presentation a couple weeks ago, and the lady from the Bureau of Reclamation said that they were completing their feasibility plan, and it would be done by 2013, and they're going to take it to Congress then. And then, you know, it'll be up to the congressional whims, and who knows what those people know about water or salmon or anything.
Right. And they were hoping what? Their guesstimation was that by 2050 we'd have some huge number of new citizens in the state of California.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, well, really? Wait till they see our new taxes coming at us. You
yeah.
know, I don't know. I don't really see that happening. So.
Yeah, and it really doesn't, you know, there is, I've seen that stat too, and I'm not a demographer, so I don't know how true that is or the accuracy of that, but, you know, whatever the water needs are, raising the Shasta Dam is extremely, anywhere you look at it, it's extremely inefficient way to do it. It's just, I was looking, you know, they're looking at the 18.5 raise and foot raise as their primary option, and I think it would cost something around $800 million, and it would only, you know, and you know, it only increase the acre feet by, you know, pretty minimal amount, and that's assuming that dam fills up, and or that lake fills up, and how often does that happen? I mean, I don't know. You guys might know that better than me, but once every few years at most.
Yeah, I just couldn't see that being.
And then,
those are the years we didn't really need the water, right?
And then, you know, there's all kinds of ways we could get that same amount of water, even more water, just by conserving a little. And so,
or by cutting back on the subsidized agriculture of cotton and alfalfa in the desert.
Sure, sure. I mean, there was Friends of a River had a stat that you know, if alfalfa farmers just saved 5% of their water, I think it would capture about 10 times as much as the 18.5 foot raise would, or something like that. So there's so many other
solutions.
There's so many other options that would be less expensive, and then you take into the fact that you would more or less be destroying a culture, because that raise would flood what's left of their sacred places, and that would mean that they can't practice their religion, they can't practice their culture, and that means, you know, how they define being Winnemem would not exist anymore. And, you know, they'll use that word genocide, and they mean it, because however you want to define it, you know, to them it means, the Shasta Dam raise means that they won't exist anymore. So.
Okay, interesting. All right, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you're listening to Positively Healthy. Don't go away. Don't even think about it. We'll be right back.
Today, most...
Hey, welcome back. Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you have just landed KCNR 1460, and you're listening to Positively Healthy.
Yeah, Mark, I'll ask you a question that an old editor of mine at Forbes magazine used to always ask, and it was a tough one sometimes, but it does focus you. Why should we care about what happens to the Winnemem Wintu?
You know, I'm sure that's a question that I'll get from a lot of people. And I feel like, you know, the theme of this story is that, you know, the dam blocks the river. And I think there are also a lot of invisible dams that separate us from each other. And I think, you know, we feel separated from all these stories, and we feel as if we're separated from the Winnemem story. And I don't think that's how it should be. I think we should view the Winnemem as an important part of who we are as a country, and an important part of our history. And they have a knowledge and a culture that we need to learn more about, and we need to make them feel comfortable in sharing what they feel comfortable with us. Because, you know, they have their understanding of how nature works and how the salmon work and how we can do better at, you know, not doing so much damage is something that we need to understand. And I think, you know, I think we need to stop saying that their story is their story and make it part of our story. And we need to feel like, I think we should feel like we're in this together, and we shouldn't let any of our friends, you know, be destroyed or eviscerated by, you know, a dam race that doesn't need to happen. And, you know, that's how I feel, too, is I feel like, you know, it was very chilling to me to be at that Shasta Dam history presentation and to see her talk about, you know, how soon that Shasta Dam race might become a reality, because those are my friends, and I don't want, you know, I want them to stay with them. I want them to be able to have their life ways, and I think, I hope from the book, other people will feel that way.
Very well said. And good luck with your book.
Thanks.
Okay, so then I kind of wanted to get back to this idea of the article that came out for you today. You had an article published today.
Mm-hmm.
And what was that about?
Well, it was kind of interesting because, you know, in the news lately there's been these stories about the Belo Monte Dam, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, in Brazil, which is a huge mega dam that would displace and flood about, I think it's estimated 20,000 indigenous people there in the Amazon. And, you know, James Cameron, the director of Avatar, went out there and he did these videos and he's like, oh, this is, you know, it's like I'm in a real life Pandora and, you know, it's important that we save this place. And so I wrote a story that, or a column that ended up writing the California Progress Report. And I was just kind of saying, you know, James Cameron didn't have to go all the way to the Amazon to find his real life Pandora. It's right here in Shasta County. And, you know, if we think it's important to save those Amazonian cultures and those indigenous people's places, we should also find it important to stand up for the Winnemem.
How is it that people like me don't know anything about the Winnemem?
You know, that's a good question. I would
I wanted to ask him.
I would think I think a lot of it is just the way history has been written. And you know that old saying that history is written by the victors kind of rings really true in this case. You know, the Shasta Dam tours don't ever mention the Winnemem. What's that author, Al Rocca, the local historian, his books never mention the Winnemem. And also, you know, the BOR goes into schools and they do their own education program with the kids in the schools.
Who does?
The BOR, Bureau of Reclamation.
Okay, okay.
And, you know, Indian history isn't really covered in the California school books. You know, Colleen, the chief, has, you know, been in various efforts to try and change that, but she's been told that it would be too psychologically trying for, you know, young kids to learn about the true history. And so I think it's just kind of like a the bottom of an ugly rock sometimes we don't want to turn over.
It seems so lovely to turn over and look at to me. I encourage you to keep turning it over.
Or maybe the right way to say it is that we think it's an ugly rock.
Yeah.
But it's really not.
Yeah, definitely. And, well, I want to thank you for coming on today. I've learned a lot, and I hope that folks in our area can... You're right, we get all excited about some group losing their culture in the Amazon, and it's happening right here, and mm-hmm. there are people we could know and talk to, and they could become our friends. Just that easy. Mm-hmm. So,
do you have any contact information you'd want to share with listeners if they've got questions? Or
I would invite them to go to the Winnemem Wintu's website, which is winnemwintu.us, and there's all kinds of information there about their history, recognition, Shasta Dam race, and the return of the salmon.
And how can they find you?
I would direct them to my just regular website, markdadigan.com.
And you are MARC?
DADIGAN.
Okay, so you're easy to find,
and
too.
If they want to send me an email, go right ahead.
Oh, excellent. And then if you get totally lost, email us, you know, and we'll send you. We'll help you find Mark and company. So, well, thanks for coming on today. We absolutely appreciate your time, and good luck with your work. And we will catch you next week. This is Dr. Trudy Pratt. And as always, go out and be healthy today, and we'll see you soon.